So explain for people what this is all about. I mean, the first time when he was president, he was going to Denmark. He canceled his trip, calling your prime minister at the time a woman, a nasty woman, for saying no to the possibility of the U.S. taking Greenland.
It was because she was saying that it was an absurd idea. I still think it's a crazy idea. And I think it's quite honestly crazy to talk about expanding your empire. You can look at different places in the world right now where people are trying to expand their empire. I think that's a crazy thing to even talk about. So back then, we said we're open for business, we're not for sale. That's the way it is still for Greenland. And Greenland has a lot of autonomy ourselves. And therefore, the decision on what should happen with the future of Greenland is up to the Greenlandic people. And we have our own government, our own parliament, and the decisions is therefore something that should be discussed back home in Greenland. But Greenland is not for sale, so it's not going to happen.
I want to ask you about the strategic significance of Greenland for the United States. It's valuable for what? Vast reserves of zinc, copper, iron ore, uranium. Can you talk about how the U.S. and China have competed for these reserves, including uranium?
We have almost any kind of rare earth minerals that the U.S. but also EU is looking for. And in many ways, we need investments when it comes to rare earth, but also raw materials. And we have almost any kind of raw materials in Greenland. So I think it's about having a collaboration both with Denmark, with EU, but also with the U.S. in order to make sure that we have a stronger position on the market when it comes to rare earths, because right now it's more or less monopoly from the Chinese side. And therefore, I think it makes sense to collaborate on rare earths, but also on tourism, on education, on business development in total. I think that would make sense to have a bigger U.S. engagement. But to do it in that sense that Trump, the president-elect, has been doing it, has been very disrespectful. So in many ways, this is really something that the people of Greenland don't like. And I think in many ways, it just brings us further away from each other. So I really think we need to have a more diplomatic approach when it comes to collaboration with Greenland, which has a lot of autonomy already and is a self-governing country.
Aaja Chemnitz, as a member of the Denmark Parliament, can you talk about the Thule Air Base, which is the now a space base? The air base was owned by the United States. In 2013, Greenland lifted a ban on mining radioactive materials. How does that all connect?
Bidufik Space Base was renamed from Thule Air Base a couple of years ago, and it was in respect for the Greenlandic people and the Greenlandic language. We're an indigenous community, and in many ways, it's very important for us to focus on community, family, and then me. And in many other Western communities, it's the other way around. So it's me, it's family, and then community. So I think it's very important to understand that the Greenlandic way of living can be a little bit different from the Western way of living. And in many ways, we have a modern good society. We have a lot of welfare. We have a lot of business development in Greenland, but we would like to see much more. We have said no to uranium. This was the last election for the parliament back home in Greenland. And it was very clear from the voters that we said no to uranium because it's an open pit mine in the backyard of a city where there's quite a lot of people living there in South Greenland. But we're pro-mining, we're pro-business. We would like to see much more development going on in Greenland, and we would like to see U.S. and EU engagement to a larger extent than what we're seeing right now.
And finally, we just have 30 seconds, but you're chair of Arctic Parliamentarians. If you can talk about how climate change has impacted Greenland. I mean, earlier this year, a study found Greenland's ice cap is losing an average of 30 million tons of ice every hour due to the effects of the climate crisis. You have a president-elect now, Trump, who often, at the end of many sentences, will say, drill, baby, drill.
Mm. You know, the climate change is affecting the temperature and the climate in Greenland four times as much as the rest of the world. And so it is in the Arctic as well. So this is really affecting our everyday life. It's affecting our hunters, our fishers, which are living off of this. And I think in many ways, it's really trying to understand climate change is not something that we have a discussion about. Is it really real? We know it's real. We can see it's real. And in many ways, I think it's important to do much more when it comes to the climate. So Greenland has signed up for the Paris Agreement because we would like to do much more when it comes to a green transition. So we're investing in power, hydropower in Greenland, to name just one example. So it's very important for us to have a much more green transition in order to make sure that we're not polluting more than we should do.
Aaja Chemnitz, I want to thank you for being with us, a member of the Danish Parliament from Greenland. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. We turn now to look at how President-elect Trump has threatened to retake the Panama Canal. The United States controlled the waterway after its completion in the early 20th century. But in 1977, President Jimmy Carter signed a landmark treaty to give Panama control of the canal, which, by providing a path through Central America, revolutionized maritime shipping. During a speech in Arizona Sunday, Trump threatened to retake the canal.
If the principles, both moral and legal, of this magnanimous gesture of giving are not followed, then we will demand that the Panama Canal be returned to the United States of America in full, quickly, and without question.
Panama's President Jose Raul Molina rejected Trump's threat in a video he posted online.
Quiero expresar de manera precisa.
I want to express that every square meter of the Panama Canal and its adjacent areas belong to Panama and will continue to belong to Panama. The sovereignty and independence of our country are not negotiable.
Meanwhile, on Wednesday, Trump announced he's picking Trump loyalist local official Kevin Moreno Cabrera from Miami to serve as U.S. ambassador to Panama. For more on this and Trump's vow to maybe also annex Canada, as he continually refers to Governor Trudeau, and even a possible soft invasion of Mexico, we're joined by the Pulitzer Prize-winning author Greg Grandin, history professor at Yale University. His recent op-ed in the New York Times headlined, "The Republicans Who Want to Invade Mexico." His forthcoming book, America, America, A New History of the New World. Thanks for joining us, Professor Grandin. First, your response to Panama.
Well, Panama is interesting. I mean, I think there's a lot of things going on. Obviously, Trump is not president yet, and he's sending out messages that are meant to set a tone. In some ways, it's classic Trump. He's saber-rattling about these fantasies about taking back the canal. But I think the real kind of prosaic reason why he's doing that is to place signal pressure on Panama to clamp down on immigration and particularly to close down the Darien Gap. Last year, I believe the numbers are quite off the charts, something like 400,000 migrants traipsed through the very narrow jungle Darien Gap as part of the migration into the United States. And by placing the pressure on Panama about the canal, this is Trump's way of bait and switch in some ways. But I think there are other things also going on. In some ways, it's distraction. The more we talk about Greenland, the more we talk about Canada and Governor Trudeau, and the more we talk about taking back the Panama Canal, the less we're talking about Syria or Gaza or these other hotspots that require significant attention and real diplomacy rather than this kind of circus act. But I also think that it speaks to this signal shift in the global order. I think that the old liberal order, multilateral order that Trump stands apart and above from and has pledged to overthrow. You know, it presided over untold number of hypocrisies and atrocities, but at least the premise that it was founded on was that nations were to cooperate with each other to create a peaceful world, and hence diplomatic protocol. Trump, by just talking about taking the canal or taking Greenland or turning Canada into the 51st state, is really hearkening back to a world where the doctrine of conquest still reigned, you know, where the presumption wasn't cooperation. The presumption was rivalry, competition, and domination, in which smaller nations suffer what they must and bigger nations do what they will. And I think that, you know, this is classic Trump. There's no way the United States is going to fill out greater America. This is red meat for the Trump base. You can go to Twitter. You can see all of these MAGA maps in which greater America is filled out from Greenland down to Panama. And it's a fantasy. There is not going to be a kind of return to territorial annexation in any significant way. I mean, the United States is not Israel, right? In Israel, there is a greater Israel being created. In the United States, it exists more in the kind of fantasy life of his rank and file, and I think that some of that is what is going on. And let me just add, it's Panama. Panama is one of the largest offshore money laundering shelters in the world. By some accounts, some $7 trillion exist in these offshore accounts. And if he really wanted to make America great, he would go after not the Panama Canal or worry about immigration. He would shut down the ability of these offshore financing to function, and he would tax that money. And then we'd have high speed trains, we'd have healthcare, we'd have a nation, as he likes to put it.
Well, just as we talked about Greenland and China and the U.S. interests in Greenland, what about the Panama Canal and the possibility of a larger canal being built through Nicaragua and the role of China versus the U.S.? Is Trump seeing it in this context?
I would obviously Latin America is and its relationship with China is always a geostrategic concern for national security types, and it has been for quite a while, and in terms of the Panama Canal in particular, there are alternatives on the table. Claudia Sheinbaum in Mexico has talked about creating an interoceanic corridor, a combination of roadways and trains in that thin kind of waistband area of Mexico that would compete with the Panama Canal. Nicaragua, of course, is run by a degraded version of the Sandinistas, but they've been in talks with China, but this has been going on for decades, so it's unclear how real they were. The thing about building alternatives to the Panama Canal is that this happens whenever. It's been going on for quite a long time, for at least a century. There's of course the problem with Panama Canal. It's not a lock canal. It's not a sea level canal. So it takes a long time to fill up the locks, bring them down, bring the ship across. And that's why the tariffs are so high. That's why the fees are so high. But it's an enormous operation. So there's been a dream of a sea level canal for over a century. And maybe the will there is to build it either in Mexico or Nicaragua. But, you know, it's not anything I would hold my breath for waiting to see happen. We'd probably have high-speed trains in the United States before that happened.
Interestingly, Trump's pick for the ambassador to Mexico is Ron Johnson, whose military career began in Panama in the 80s. He was stationed in El Salvador as one of 55 U.S. military advisors, as the Salvadoran military and paramilitaries were killing thousands of Salvadorans. He was a specialist in covert operations, became a member of the elite U.S. Special Forces, informally known as the Green Berets, a highly selective unit. unit that also included figures like Trump's pick for National Security Advisor Michael Waltz. He has pushed for the U.S. also invading Mexico. Greg, as we wrap up.
Yeah, these are bad signs. Ron Johnson just brings us back to Iran-Contra. I mean, right into the heart of it. I mean, he was one of the so-called 55 military advisors on the ground in El Salvador while the United States was helping El Salvador build a death squad state. I mean, he's got, and then the then he had the Korean Green Berets and onward to the CIA. He's seen some things, and to name him the ambassador to Mexico is again sending a strong signal. Again, Mexico is Mexico. It's stubborn. It has a strong commitment to sovereignty. On the other hand, it's poor and it needs capital. And the United States is the largest trading partner. Claudia Sheinbaum seems to be very astute in not. Where we see obsequiousness on the part of Justin Trudeau. Sheinbaum has come back quite strongly, at least rhetorically, on Trump. But on the other hand, Mexico has cooperated with the United States on all sorts of things having to do with migration and including helping the United States enforce a hard line on migration. I imagine that's going to continue no matter what the rhetoric of Sheinbaum. But Mexico does has a much stronger commitment to the idea of sovereignty because of the history. When we started talking about territorial annexation, I mean, a third of Mexico was lost to the United States. Texas was lost to the United States. The United States almost took the Yucatan in 1848 along with Texas. So that history is there. And of course, the people that Trump has put in Marco Rubio as Secretary of State, Ron Johnson, Mike Waltz. I mean, they might as well move the State Department down to Mar-a-Lago or down to Tampa. I mean, it's basically a Florida-based operation, which suggests that we're going to see a lot of interesting rivalries or a lot of interesting conflicts with Latin America, which might reveal some big cleavages. Because one of the things that
we just have 20 seconds, Greg.
Okay, one of the things that the Trump people want to do is build an alliance with right-wing Latin Americans. And you ain't going to do that by threatening to take back the Panama Canal.
Yes, even the Wall Street Journal editorial page, well known for its conservatism, said, Trump, you did not campaign on this issue. Where is it coming from? Greg Grandin, Pulitzer Prize-winning author and professor of history at Yale University. We'll link to your New York Times op-ed headlined, The Republicans Who Want to Invade Mexico. We'll also link to Tracy Wilkerson's piece in the New York Times, Tracy Wilkerson's Los Angeles Times piece about Ron Johnson. Next up, we talked with longtime Silicon Valley venture capitalist Roger McNamee, author of Zucked, Waking Up to the Facebook Catastrophe, about the tech oligarchs. Back in 20 seconds. Singer Ruben Blades. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. We look now at the influence of Silicon Valley and the tech billionaires and the incoming Trump administration as tech companies line up to support the president-elect, a major difference from his first term. Tech billionaire Elon Musk is one of Trump's closest advisors. Earlier this month, he was there when Amazon billionaire Jeff Bezos had dinner with Trump at Mar-a-Lago. Meta CEO Mark Zuckerberg had dinner at Mar-a-Lago. Chicago last month. Amazon, Meta, and OpenAI's Sam Altman have all announced donations of $1 million each to Trump's inaugural committee. This comes as Trump chose tech execs Scott Kupor and Sriram Krishnan for key roles this week. They'll likely work closely with another tech executive, David Sachs, who Trump has picked to be czar of crypto and artificial intelligence. As we reported earlier, Trump on Sunday also tapped billionaire tech investor Ken Howery as U.S. ambassador to Denmark. Howery co-founded PayPal with Max Levchin, Luke Nozick, Peter Thiel, and Elon Musk. For more, we're joined by longtime Silicon Valley venture capitalist Roger McNamee, author of Zucked, Waking Up to the Facebook Catastrophe. He had a 34-year career in Silicon Valley, was an early investor in Facebook. Welcome back to Democracy Now, Roger. Thanks so much for waking up for this program. If you can start off by talking about what you think it's most important for people to understand about what Elon Musk, what people are calling President Musk, being in charge just last week, leading off the crisis of whether the government would shut down, making billions since the election as he poured millions or $250 million into Trump's victory.
So, Amy, I think there are two things that stand at the top of the list of all Silicon Valley executives right now. The first thing is they all want tax cuts. These are billionaires. They don't want to pay taxes on their wealth. The second issue, though, relates to their products. Tech has undergone a massive transformation culturally. It used to be about empowerment. It used to be about productivity. But for the last 15 years, the industry has been increasingly adversarial with their customers as they have tried to deploy increasingly authoritarian technologies into the marketplace. And they have put David Sachs in charge of the two that are the leading edge right now, which is to say cryptocurrency and artificial intelligence. And the thing that makes me really sad as someone who spent the last 8 years warning about the threat from Silicon Valley is that we're going to see a massive, uncontrolled experiment on the American population. And I have absolutely no idea how this is going to turn out.
So they are clearly extremely interested in tax cuts and deregulation. Can you talk about the significance of this, what this means for the health of the nation?
So Amy, I think here's the fundamental challenge, that Americans for too long have trusted Silicon Valley. You know, for 50 years, the products that came out of the Valley made us more capable. They made us more productive. That is no longer the case. And we have maintained this increasingly tight relationship with technology products, essentially treating everything new as though it would automatically be better than what came before. That has not been the case since the iPhone was introduced in 2007. And so the point I would make to everybody is I think we need to change our relationship to technology. You know, what you're seeing in this space is exactly what the professor just described going on in foreign affairs, which is there are a lot of distractions, a lot of things being thrown out there to grab your attention. But the core things come down to displacing workers with artificial intelligence, displacing the currency with crypto, and getting rid of any kind of taxation on wealth that might come up. And that's the agenda. It's really straightforward. And the only power we have as citizens, and I think it's a huge power, is to sit there and say, you know what? We're not going to use your products anymore. And we have been accepting all kinds of invasions of privacy, all kinds of surveillance, all kinds of manipulation in exchange for convenience. I think it's time for us to look at that relationship and ask, could we do with less convenience for a while in exchange for regaining human autonomy? That's a trade I've made a number of years ago and have encouraged others to do. And I just think it's really the only option that we have for at least the next 4 years.
Talk about the relationship of these tech billionaires or oligarchs with workers. I mean, you have Amazon workers out all over the country on strike. Jeff Bezos also owns The Washington Post. Of course, Bezos and Patrick Soon-Shiong, who owns The Los Angeles Times, stopped the endorsements of their editorial boards for Kamala Harris. But the significance of how they deal with workers and what this administration will mean.
But if you go back, the great Meredith Whitaker at Signal wrote an essay, I don't know, maybe a year and a half ago, about the history of computing and how even back to the 1850s, the predecessor technologies that led to computing were all about control of labor. And it started on plantations and controlling slaves. And you have seen a steady evolution. It was broken temporarily, it turns out, by the personal computer, which in fact empowered people. And then the internet did the same thing. These guys have been attempting to revert to centralized control ever since. And so that their goal is really, really simple. If you watch artificial intelligence, for example, the mania for AI began, and I do not think this is a coincidence, when Silicon Valley workers resisted going back into the office after COVID. And the first market they tried to sell it to was Hollywood during the writer's strike and the Screen Actors Guild strike. And I think it's really simple. There are ads in San Francisco right now about how you should not employ any more humans. You know, you can employ AI instead of humans. And I sit there and ask a really basic question. Who does that serve? You know, our children are being lured into using ChatGPT for school. And in what way does that benefit them? It doesn't prepare them for a future in which they're empowered. It prepares them for a future in which they are disempowered.
Roger McNamee, how is all this going to be powered? Microsoft wants a nuclear power plant like Three Mile Island. Explain the role of nuclear power, AI, and cryptocurrency.
Amy, this is such an important question. You know, even if you thought that artificial intelligence was useful, and to be clear, it is not at all obvious that the utility of it is anything like as valuable as the cost. But the starting assumptions are totally flawed. So the industry starts by stealing all copyrighted information, as well as all the personal information that all of us have in cloud services. So if you think about things you might have in Google Docs, or, you know, that you might have in an email server or in an app that does your productivity apps, you know, all of those things are being absorbed. So that's a theft. But the second problem, the really huge one, is what it does to natural resources. If you look at Microsoft and Google in particular, both had made commitments to carbon neutrality by 2030. Both in the past year abandoned those commitments because their power consumption has gone nonlinear, up 30, 40, 50% over the last few years, simply to power artificial intelligence. The same thing's going on with water. A lot of these processing plants, both for the data and for semiconductors, are located in deserts. And so they're consuming massive amounts of water. And the public has had no voice in this. The companies have acted unilaterally, and they're at the point now where they're literally talking about restarting Three Mile Island in Microsoft's case, or building floating nuclear plants in the Northwest in the case of Amazon. And I would simply observe that the public really should have a voice in this. And what we decided in this last election is that we were going to forego that vote and let the industry have control of it. And it, you know, I seriously have no idea how this is going to turn out. And I think the only power we have is to say no.
We just have 30 seconds, Roger. But according to the Bloomberg Billionaires Index, Elon Musk's worth soared over 70% to $450 billion after the presidential elections. The significance of this?
Well, everything about Trump appears to be pay to play, right? All of these executives are giving $1 million each. These are rounding error numbers. This is money they find between the cushions of the couch in their living room. But they're, you know, it's basically a protection payment. And in Musk's case, the investment he made in Trump, which was $250 million, or the investment he made in Twitter, which is like $44 billion, those have paid off, obviously, many, many times over. I believe that Trump and Musk will eventually part ways. I don't know Trump at all, but he doesn't seem like the kind of guy who would put up with someone who competes at the level that Musk competes at. But we'll have to see how that turns out.
Well, we will have a further conversation with you on this. Roger McNamee, longtime Silicon Valley investor, author of Zucked, Waking Up to the Facebook Catastrophe. That does it for the show. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
For 40 years, the Simon Fraser Public Interest Research Group, a.k.a. SFPERG, has been helping students build communities at SFU. Campus organizations like Out on Campus and Embark developed out-of-action groups at SFPERG. Action groups are one of the ways that student activists can take action for change. Visit us at www.sfpirg.ca. That's www.sfpirg.ca to learn more about starting your own action group today.
Staff and volunteers.